Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As this year comes to an end, we thought we'd put together some of our very favorite segments from the past year. Let's take a listen to one now. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As we head into the holiday season, I will tell you that one of my favorite things about the holidays, apart from spending time with people I love, is the food. Thanksgiving is my favorite food holiday, hands down. Christmas ranks second. And if anyone wants to invite me over to some Hanukkah dinner for Lakis, I'm in. For many, this is also the time of year to freak out, though, about healthy eating even more than people normally do, especially if you're on the all-too-trendy paleo diet or whatever diet you're subscribing to these days, if you're trying to be low-carb or high-fat, or maybe you're a vegan or are going gluten-free. Whatever your choices are, it's exhausting trying to eat right, and often you're just left hungry. Dr. Aaron Carroll knows all about this struggle and the science behind it. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times and is the author of a new book called The Bad Food Bible, How and Why to Eat Sinfully. He joins me now from Indiana University, where he's a professor of pediatrics and the associate dean for research mentoring. Dr. Carroll, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Carroll, I wanted to start by sharing a story with you because as I was reading your book, I was thinking about this. I was diagnosed with breast cancer earlier this year, and before I started chemotherapy, when I was meeting with my oncology nutritionist, we talked about my diet, and then she said something that I feel like no doctor has ever said. She just said, "So look, it sounds like you eat pretty healthy. Do not do anything strange to your diet during chemotherapy." She said, just be reasonable, eat whatever you want to eat, eat whatever feels good to you, and don't worry about anything else. And I feel like people were horrified that she said that to me, and they said she should have been giving you better medical advice. And I wonder for
what?
You, yeah, if
oh
that
my God.
Was...
Yeah, I was going to say, you struck gold. That's like
that's what I was going to say to
I've
you.
Heard.
Right.
No, I mean,
but
I
that's
have, I have
not what we hear from people.
Yeah. No. Yeah, in fact, I have friends who were diagnosed with breast cancer and got the exact opposite message. It became immediately like, this is a list of things that you did wrong, which, of course, sent them into a shame spiral of like.
Oh, well, people said that to me. No, don't get me wrong. Lots of people told me that. But my doctors never said that to me.
No, right. I've heard doctors, plenty of doctors and nutritionists say that too. And because doctors are human beings and they fall prey to the same kind of messages that. Everyone else does, as do nutritionists. And so many scientists, doctors, nutritionists, guideline writers have gotten this wrong again and again and again and again and again. But unfortunately, that's too often how we talk about food, is by scaring people, by moralizing, by making people afraid. And I'm thrilled that you got that message from your doctor, but that's, I will tell you, that's probably not normal.
Right. And that's what your book is about, right? Because
yeah.
Let's say someone is not... does not have cancer or another illness that maybe people want to think about special eating, or you write a lot about pregnancy. I wonder what you think about the messages we have and how hard it is in society as just humans to deal with all of the different, and you write about this, the different research and studies and the completely conflicting messages we get all the time about what to eat.
Well, unfortunately, I think the conflicting messages are almost always telling you what not to eat. Nobody ever says, like, oh, yes, it's okay. But, you know, I would say that probably, you know, a theme of the book, and it's so many of the columns I write, is that whenever you're making any kind of health decision, period, you need to weigh both the benefits and the harms. You cannot just focus on one side. And unfortunately, I think when it comes to food, when it comes to messaging, we almost entirely always pick the harm side. It's fear-based. I mean, just last week, there was an article that got a lot of, I mean, an announcement that got articles all over the place that once again said alcohol causes cancer and sent everyone into a panic. But it only focused once again on the harm side. And the harms, while perhaps greater than zero for some people, are very, very, very small. And of course, there are also benefits to consider from any kind of dietary decision. And those include joy. Those include cost. You know, you started by talking about how this time of year and the holidays that come up are your favorite food holidays. Why would someone try to take that away from you?
For I feel like everyone's trying to take it away from us, aren't they?
Yeah, that makes no sense. I mean, you know, for forever, eating and, you know, shared meals, these are times of joy and of family and of coming together. And we've turned, unfortunately, eating into this incredibly bad scientific process that has almost no humanity left to it, but is just based in fear. And part of what I tried to do in the book is explain that the science behind that fear is almost never there, in which case you're just adding harm to your life for really no benefit. And that's just not a rational decision, and we should be thinking about food much differently.
I'm speaking with Dr. Alan Carroll. He's the author of The Bad Food Bible. He also teaches at Indiana University School of Medicine. I'm sorry, Dr. Aaron Carroll. Dr. Carroll, can I just ask you about the science behind everything? Because you talk about this in the book. Can you just give us a quick kind of rundown of when we see study, those of us who are not medical researchers think, okay, this is a gold standard of study, but you go through in your book all of the different ways that a lot of these are not necessarily randomized controlled trials.
Right. So there's sort of a hierarchy of studies, or of we should say scientific evidence, and sort of what you can believe in that knowing that something causes something else. Anytime you read a news story about some big breakthrough in medicine and it involves 8 genetically identical male mice, take it with a grain of salt. I mean, just, you know, the difference between all of the collected humanity and how we make decisions about nutrition and tiny animals in a lab are not the same. Then the next sort of level of study is just the anecdote, which is just, I heard something or somebody, oh, I have a friend who got a disease and they ate a lot of this and therefore, no, that has no science behind it. Neither do really case series, which are just collected anecdotes. Then you get into sort of case control studies, which are just, I got a bunch of people with cancer and a bunch of people that didn't together and tried to figure out a difference. Case control studies are how you hear things in the news like cell phones cause cancer, even though cancer rates are not through the roof and everyone uses a cell phone. And there are sort of epidemiologic or cohort studies, which is what most food studies are, which are just basically big collected studies of people trying to find associations. And they're fine for associations, which are ideas about maybe something is associated with something else and we should look into it further. But the only kinds of studies that can tell us if something causes something else are what we call randomized controlled trials. Those are when we set up prospective trials and we get one group of people to do one thing and another group of people to do another thing. Ideally, they shouldn't even know what they're doing, the difference, and then we test what happens over time. Those are the only kinds of studies in general that can really prove causality. And they're rare in nutrition. And when we have them, too often we ignore them. And so, you know, even this is last week's news with cancer and alcohol. You know, we don't have any kind of randomized controlled trials with cancer, but we do have some randomized controlled trials of alcohol, and they've shown that they might reduce some chances of diabetes, and they might be actually protective with respect to some heart disease. So I'm not telling you to go out and drink, but I would say that we too often overemphasize studies which we shouldn't put too much stock in and ignore the studies that are much more powerful. And unfortunately, we do that in nutrition all of the time.
And there's so many studies about fat. Can I ask you about that? What does it matter what kind of fat we're eating? What do you think?
So, oh man, so it's like, this is where it's like, I would love to give you a definitive answer, but even still, the jury is out. I will say that not long ago, we used to be afraid of all fat equally. Well, first of all, trans fats and made in a lab bad for you, but you almost can't find them anymore. But the case against unsaturated fat is almost gone. The idea that you need to fear unsaturated fat at all or try to limit it. I think even in the latest USDA guidelines, they finally come around and said, like, look, no one should be really limiting their unsaturated fat. With saturated fat, the jury is still out. You can find studies that show that if you can replace saturated fat with unsaturated fat, that might be a good thing. However, replacing saturated fat with carbs, not a good idea. And, you know, studies don't support that. So, you know, the diets that try to really, truly get you to limit all your fats do not have a lot of evidence behind them. In fact, you know, diets like the Mediterranean diet or diets which emphasize unsaturated fat appear to be very healthy and are some of the few that have randomized controlled data behind them. But, you know, in general, we are much more afraid of fat than we should be, and it's very likely that the sort of low-fat craze of the 60s and 70s and even the 80s pushed a lot of people into diets that were not good and might have contributed to the obesity epidemic in general.
So when it comes to foods, you're saying we can eat cheese, we can eat meat, they can be full fat?
Yeah, and well, it's like I wouldn't go crazy with it, but in moderation, absolutely. The studies, even with meat, that show true danger. I mean, we're talking about studies where they're counting the number of servings of red meat people eat per day. Most people don't do that. It's like, don't. So yes, maybe don't eat multiple servings of processed red meat a day. But in general, there's nothing wrong with meat if it's part of a healthy diet. And even meat that has some saturated fat is likely fine as long as it's part of a well-balanced diet. And the only red meat, the only I'd say red meat that even sort of purists can point and say, well, we truly believe that this causes cancer, is processed red meat. And it's a relative risk. So this is one of the examples that I often use, where if I, Aaron Carroll, committed to eating an extra serving of 3 pieces of bacon every day for the rest of my life, my overall risk of cancer, lifetime risk of cancer, might go up by something like half a percentage point overall. I'm not going to eat that much bacon. I'm not going to do that. And that's not that big a risk overall if I chose to do it. So likely you're not going to get that much of a risk. It's not going to make that much of a difference in your life, and you're not going to eat that much in general. So trying to always pitch it in these very scary messages about your relative risk of getting a bad disease, they just don't hold water, and they're much scarier than they are in reality.
And I think you mentioned sort of the obsession in the 70s and the 80s with fat. I think what everyone talks about now is gluten and being gluten-free. Do you think people should
Yeah.
be avoiding gluten?
Well, look, if you're part of the one less than 1% of the population that has celiac disease, absolutely you have to. And if you're
Less
less
than
if,
1%
if
of the
you're
population, I should, you
Yes,
said.
exactly. We're talking less than 1% of the population has celiac disease. Even fewer people in the United States have a true wheat allergy, and they may want to avoid, they have to avoid wheat in general, so avoiding gluten might be good for them. But the other 20+% of us that aren't in those two categories and yet are purchasing gluten-free food all the time are not getting really any benefit. There is no scary thing about gluten. It's been part of our diet forever. Wheat still in the rest of the world is pretty much, with the exception perhaps of rice, but they're pretty close. 20% of the world's calories come from wheat worldwide, and people are not suffering because they're being exposed to gluten. They're not. It's just this is a United States thing, and it's often, again, a fear thing where we've sort of latched on to what's the panic du jour. Many people are focusing on gluten, but the vast, vast, vast majority of people who are, trying to find a gluten-free diet aren't there. People will claim that they are sometimes gluten intolerant, which is a vague set of symptoms. In studies, the people that claim they're gluten intolerant rarely meet the criteria, and even when they do, they don't see benefit in good studies from going on a gluten-free diet. So we can't find evidence for this. And yet again, as I said before, something like 20+% of Americans are still searching out gluten-free food, which often has less nutrients, often has more calories, certainly costs more. You're not getting much of a benefit. You're living in fear once again, and it's really not doing much good. We spend a couple $1 billion on gluten-free dog food each year. And again, this is how far we go, is we're now searching for phantom problems in our pets, as well as just within ourselves. There's no reason to be this afraid of a food that has been with us since like the dawn of man.
So, Dr. Carroll,
We've been
right,
eating wheat, it's fun.
what do you say to people? We just have a minute or two left, but I wonder what you say to people. I have friends who insist that removing gluten from their diet has made them so healthy and it's made them better people and that they've lost weight and that they're no longer sick because they're not eating gluten. What do you say to people when they tell you
So,
that?
one, I don't ever try to change people's behavior if they're happy doing what they're doing. Fine. Like, if it works for you, I'm thrilled. I have a problem when they try to tell me or other people what to do. What most of them are seeing is the opposite of the placebo effect. It's called the nocebo effect. So it's well documented that people will, if they believe something is going to work, it is more likely to work. That's the placebo effect. The nocebo effect is the exact same thing in the opposite. If they believe something is harmful, they get a harm. And if they eliminate it, they sometimes feel a benefit. So if people believe strongly enough that gluten is doing them harm, then sometimes when they give it up, they see an improvement. That's fine again, but of course it wanes over time because it's not real, it's partly imagined. The other thing is that sometimes, by going on a gluten-free diet, people improve their diet in general. They reduce the number of processed foods they're eating, they reduce perhaps their intake of refined carbohydrates, they start to eat more, a well-balanced diet of protein and fruits and vegetables. So so be it. Like, I'm all for that. I have no problem if people want to eat healthier diets in general and see a benefit, but they shouldn't be telling other people they're doing it wrong or living in fear. You can eat a better diet, a more healthy diet, without 100% eliminating gluten from your diet. You could just reduce it, perhaps, or reduce your intake of processed foods, which are often linked with gluten.
Dr. Carroll, we just have about 30 seconds left. Can you give us a rule of thumb as we think about holiday eating? I know you're going to give us a life rule in general, but how should we be thinking about food?
So again, you know, it's one, two, three days a year. Enjoy yourself. That's my first message. Just you know, in general, try to eat pretty healthily. But on Thanksgiving, all bets go out the window. I'm having extra pie. I'm just going to. Like, it's a holiday. I'm allowed. And there's no proven lifetime benefit of trying to, you know, make myself scared and live like, you know, ascetic on that one day a year. So, you know, make sustained changes over time. That's how you fix your diet for a lifetime. Don't worry about the one day.
That's Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's the author of The Bad Food Bible, How and Why to Eat Sinfully. He also teaches at Indiana University School of Medicine, where he joined us from. Thanks for being with me, Dr. Carroll.
Thank you.
Welcome back to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
All the time. I think I was like 10 or 11.
It was young. I was young.
The way we hustle, we always help with the carts. You know what I mean? Hey, ma'am, can we help you? Hey, we help you to the carts.
Any little dollars or stuff we get, you know, a dollar was worth a lot.
One day we up there and we helping people or whatever. That's how I got my nickname, Batman. I never forget that. Romeo, he was like, man, you black as hell. I'm like, man, whatever. He like, for real, you like a Batman suit.
That's a bit from an audio documentary that was released by ProPublica Illinois, WBEZ, and the Chicago Sun-Times. When we talk about gun violence in Chicago, the conversation often goes to how people get those guns, and that's often illegally. And that's the subject of investigative reporting by ProPublica Illinois. Mick Dumke joined us to talk about this piece, which was co-published with the Sun-Times and is part of WBEZ's Every Other Hour Gun Violence series. Hey, Mick, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks. Good to see you.
So your reporting showed, let's just start with the big picture, right? That the city of Chicago has seized almost 7,000 illegal firearms so far this year. That goes along with efforts by federal authorities to take down these dealers. How does this work? I think when people think about guns and illegal guns, I mean, I would think, oh, maybe this operates like drugs, which is something you've covered a lot of also.
That's right. Yeah, I seem to be drawn to
all
these uplifting topics. Well, I think the first thing is just to explain to people what we mean by illegal guns. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about a type of gun that's illegal per se. I mean, some of those, that may be the case in some instances, but when we say the police recovered or seized 7,000 illegal guns, we're talking about guns that for the most part were bought legally at one point and then were transferred to someone illegally. People hear about straw purchases, for instance. Someone goes who is qualified to buy a gun and obtains it and then transfers it to someone who's not authorized to have a gun. Or they were stolen, loaned out, all sorts of reasons. What I found is from talking to people, a lot of the guns that police recover here are really old. They're several years old in a lot of instances, or even older. So as a police official said to me, they bounce around a lot and people in Chicago don't get rid of their guns. They seem to hold on to them. So a lot of the guns we're talking about have been around for a while. And that's really important because it's hard to find out where they came from. Not necessarily that original purchase. They've been found to come mostly from out of state, but between the time somebody bought it, say in Indiana or Arkansas, and the time they show up in Chicago on the street or used in a crime, often it's a mystery what happened in between.
And then there are the sort of these people who are in between then who are the people who are kind of, using, I don't know if broker is the right word or what you want to use for the people who have this kind of market where they are obtaining or arranging different sales of these weapons?
Yeah, I think that there's all sorts of middlemen, middle women. One of the experts I talked to, who is a researcher at the University of Chicago Crime Lab, compared this to teenagers getting beer. Every adult is potentially a source for beer. Beer is legal. So unlike cocaine or heroin, guns are also legal in this country. Yes, there are some regulations, some restrictions, but the Supreme Court over and over has reminded us that guns are legal here. So this is a legal product. So it's the market for it is almost infinite in the sense that it's basic economics, Nyla. It's people want guns and people are willing to supply them. So there is a marketplace for it. And we have glimpses of the underground market, but we don't have a great picture because it's underground. I mean, so that's the bottom line. But to your point, there are undoubtedly some larger scale traffickers who are moving around some big quantities of weapons. But it appears that by and large, most transactions involve a couple of people, a couple of guns. Usually these are people in the same social networks. You know, again, making a sale because they need the money or they just want to get rid of something, all sorts of reasons. And
right,
so I
and
think
that,
that's why it's
right.
hard to get to drill down on this.
And that's what you did, though. You did find one story of one person, Batman, we heard, or John Thomas is his. So I guess Batman becomes like his sort of street name, his street persona, right? How did you find this guy?
Well, I met him at federal court through his attorney, Heather Winslow. I was at the Chicago Sun-Times at the time, and with a couple colleagues, we were taking a close look at what the federal government was doing about Chicago's gun violence epidemic, and specifically the kinds of cases they were pursuing. So I came across John's case in the court, in court records, and you know, I was intrigued because there were, I think, at least 14 defendants. There may have even been a couple added on later, but there were more than a dozen men who were associated with this case. And John was kind of listed as the top defendant. He was somebody who brokered a bunch of gun sales, as it turned out, 23 different deals.
Right, and that involved like 77 guns?
77 guns total.
Yeah.
And then I met John through his lawyer. I was really curious about the case, and she offered to introduce me to him. And Nyla, you know, I don't know what images you or your audience has about someone who is participating in deals involving 77 guns, but John probably doesn't meet that image.
Why do you say that?
Because he's really charming. He's like a nice guy. And you sit down with him and start chatting with him, and he's very likable. He's easy to talk to. He's not... to me, I didn't ever feel like he was trying to hide something. And I say that I've covered a lot of criminal justice issues, and I know a lot of people who are in the system, I should say almost everybody's in the system, by and large has a reason or an excuse. And I'm not saying John didn't rationalize some of the things he did, but I'm also just saying that an important part of the story to me is the human beings involved and why they make the decisions they make. How can we construct public policy if we don't understand who these individuals are and what motivates them? Right?
That's sad, right. We're talking to Mick Dumke. He's a reporter with ProPublica Illinois. We're talking about there's a whole series of reporting that came out this week. It's ProPublica Illinois' first investigation, and it looks at this whole issue of guns, how they're obtained and sold illegally. We're going to tweet out all the links. There's a story. There's a fantastic audio documentary that was released yesterday. I want to just play a little bit more of that as you're talking about John so we can hear a little bit more of his story. In this case, the whole employment side of it.
So I tell him, like, look, this my block. You feel me? Y'all open store over here. I got to have something for free. I just told him straight out. They're like, what's your name? I say, I'm Batman. He what? I say, Batman.
Ali wasn't having it. Not from John. Not from Batman. John started selling weed out in front of the store. Each time he did, Ali, or Ali's son Muhammad, called the cops. One day, they made a deal.
He like, how about I give you a job? I said, you give me a job? Okay, how much you gonna pay me? He like, I'll pay you good masati. You know, that mean money. He was giving me like $65 a day. So I'm young. You know, $65 a day, that's a lot of money.
All right, so that's a little bit, as we were saying, of hearing about John. How much of this is, and this is, you go into this in the, it's 20 minutes, the whole documentary, and we'll tweet that out for everybody to listen, and we're just kind of playing a little bits of it here. obviously, a lot of this, and we hear this all the time, right? You want to solve the problem of violence in Chicago. People need jobs. How much of this is, how much of that is John's story? He needs a job. He's, and he's someone who has, you know, we hear him, he starts off how he's kind of a hustler on the street. He has a couple offenses. So how hard does, where does that factor into also his ability to find legitimate employment?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think, you know, from early on, John got a criminal record. He was, he pleaded guilty to a felony drug charge. I forget what exact age he was, but it was late teens or early 20s. At that time, he was working for one of the neighborhood drug dealers and selling crack on the street. And so he picked up a felony. And, you know, it's, I don't probably have to tell anybody out there, it's very difficult once you pick up a felony to try to go back to mainstream legal work. John did, though. He held a lot of jobs. He worked at grocery stores, worked at restaurants. The clip you played there was when a new convenience store opened in his neighborhood, and he essentially went up and tried to hustle or shake down the owners, and they said, forget it, like, get out of here.
But then he said, I'll give you a job.
And that's the thing about John. Again, he's really charming, and he is a natural salesman. I always kept thinking throughout this piece, Nyla, that, again, I want to stress that I'm not saying John is innocent. John didn't say he's innocent. He pleaded guilty and to the charges, the gun charges, the case that we're talking about. But, you know, I just kept thinking that if he'd grown up in my neighborhood, even if he'd gotten in trouble, he would have had other chances to kind of right the ship and do something productive. He would have gone into business. He would have been running his own operation.
But he grew up in a neighborhood, part of South Shore, that's called Terrortown. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's southeast part of South Shore. And
in Chicago.
In Chicago. And I'm not sure where that nickname came from. I actually taught at an alternative high school there a long time ago in the 90s. And my students were calling it that way back then. And so it was an old name, you know, 20 some years ago, it was still an old name. So it's been around for a long time. I don't think that probably a lot of residents find that a particularly flattering name, but that's what John and a lot of other young men who grew up there, that's what they call it, because again, it's had some issues with gang violence through the years. So I just, you know, I bring this up because to your question about John and the need for money and the need for employment, I think it was always a struggle. We can't blame it all on the neighborhood. John, you know, was raised by an aunt and uncle. And
who were very church-going people.
Church-going people. Yeah. To this day, John is religious. He'll, if you run into him, he'll start quoting the Bible in the middle of talking about a street hustle. I mean, that's just kind of how he is. You don't want to paint with a broad brush about everybody in the neighborhood or even everyone who's gotten in trouble with the neighborhood. But for John, I think it was always, by his own admission, it was a struggle to kind of stay on the straight and narrow and then resist the temptations of these people he enjoyed hanging out with on the street.
So in practical terms, tell me the money differential between what John was doing with legitimate employment and then what he was doing to... He was just like brokering gun sales.
Yeah, so to speed up the story a little bit, he cycled in and out of mainstream jobs, all of which are kind of, let's face it, dead-end opportunities one way or another. When you become a so-called grown-up, I think it's hard to make a full-time living, you know, bagging groceries at the store or whatever. And so, you know, John had this job, had a bunch of jobs. He lost them or you know, they phased out one way or another. So he found himself in a position, Nyla, where he had an infant daughter. He's in his late 20s, he's an infant daughter, and he's got a job at a tobacco store on the South Side where they're paying him just $25 a day. So incredibly, you know, he's making like $125 a week. And so one of the guys who hung around the store that John became friendly with came up to him one day and said, hey, I know you're hard up. I got an opportunity for you. I'll help you out if you help me out and help me find some guns. And John says he told him, look, where I'm from, we don't sell guns, which is a whole another kind of question. Guns were in circulation, but they were very quiet, John said, about, you know, somebody might know somebody who had a gun, but it wasn't like people walking around saying, hey, I got a gun
for sale.
Hey, you
want to buy a gun?
That just didn't happen.
Right.
Very quiet about it. So some guy coming up to him saying, hey, I want to get my hands on some guns. How can you do it? I think, you know, John says he was kind of thrown by that at first and had no interest initially.
And then he does do it. He starts making a lot of money. And then the problem, though, is that John doesn't realize he's actually kind of being set up. So I wanted to want to just play a little bit of that.
John, right? What's going on, John?
We get there, and we end up talking to some nerdy guy with glasses.
And this is in daytime. What happened today?
That nerdy guy is a special agent with the ATF.
This is based on things that have happened over the last 7 months.
He was thinking he's slick.
You know where I'm going with this?
Yeah. The nerdy guy and another agent are sitting on one side of a table. John is on the other. He acts like he doesn't know why he's been brought in.
Who is this? You're not in here because we just picked you up on the street. Don't act stupid.
On the table between them are several manila folders filled with pictures.
You don't know them?
They're still images, apparently pulled from the videos Yusef has been secretly recording for the ATF. There are pictures of John's cousin Steve, BD, and John. John looks confused.
You put all this together? Think about what you've been doing since January?
I ain't been doing nothing.
Then he suddenly realizes who set him up.
I'm like, Yusef. Yeah, Yusef. And I'm like, Dad, Yusef just called me 2 days ago.
So that's Yusef setting him up because Yusef, it turns out, as you find out, has also been, is working for the federal government. John ends up now, just to shorten the story, John's now actually, he ends up getting convicted.
Yeah, so the guy we were talking about a minute ago, John met while he was working at the tobacco shop, ended up luring him into this scheme to acquire and then sell guns. And it turned out that that guy, his name is Yusef, was himself being watched by and eventually squeezed by the federal government. So he decides to cooperate so that he can hopefully get a lighter sentence. And then he essentially works for several months to get John and 13 other guys recorded doing these illegal gun deals. So 14 guys get arrested all at one fell swoop. This is in August 2014. And one by one, they all plead guilty.
Is it clear that this makes a difference going after these guys one by one?
Well, I think that's the big question, especially in this case, Nyla, where there's no evidence any of them was selling guns before the federal government got involved and started using taxpayer money to do stings. And so the question is, without the government getting involved and kind of setting these deals up, would they have ever happened? John says absolutely not. He never was selling guns until the government started paying him to do so. Doesn't mean he's not guilty. He pleaded guilty. He did the deals. He played a part in it. But, If the gun market didn't exist beforehand and the government creates it and then busts everybody else, does that send a deterrent? That's what they say, but I think it's an open question.
That's Mick Dumke. He's a reporter with ProPublica Illinois. He did this deep dive on how Chicago gets its guns, which was co-published with WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times. We'll tweet out a link to his piece if you follow us at 21st Show. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Earlier this year, the Rockford East girls basketball team's best season in school history came to an end. The team lost to Boylan Catholic High School in the sectional finals, but it was how they lost that had many fans and coaches upset. Boylan, a predominantly white team, shot three times as many free throws during the game than Rockford East, a predominantly black team. Head coach L.A. Malone raised questions about the all-white officiating crew and questioned whether racial bias was a factor in the loss. Racial bias when calling fouls is something researchers have questioned for years throughout all levels of basketball. In a 2007 National Bureau of Economic Research study found that, quote, more personal fouls are called against players when they're officiated by an opposite race refereeing crew than when officiated by an own race crew, and how much that impacts the game. Later, we're going to be joined by one of the researchers behind that study to talk more about that. But first, joining me now is L.A. Malone, head coach of Rockford East girls basketball team. L.A., thanks for taking time to talk with me on the 21st. Welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Can you tell me what happened in that game against Boylan back in February?
You pretty much summed it up. I mean, they shot 37 free throws. They hit 30 out of 37 free throws. And we shot 10. We went 6 for 10. So each team, you know, hit a high percentage of their free throws. But when you outshoot a team, you know, 27 free shots in a sectional championship game with the type of teams that these, you know, us and Boylan were this year, that just, like you said, it raised a lot of questions. It really does, so.
And so do you feel
that's basically what happened, but yeah. It was a really exciting game. And, you know, like I said, they shot 37 free throws. So,
you feel like your girls were being called? Yeah. Do you feel like your girls were getting called for more fouls? Like you felt like it was unfair?
Yes.
Would you say that, and why would you say, I mean, you've played ball all the way up to semi-pro level. Would you say that you feel like this is a common thing? Maybe this happens that there's some kind of implicit bias against black players.
Yeah, I feel it's an implicit bias, but it's something. The reason I say implicit, what I mean by that is, you know, sometimes people don't realize, you know, they're doing it as well. So, you know, I know we do play, you know, bring race into it and all that, and. You know, I wouldn't say, you know, a particular person is racist unless I absolutely know them. So most of the refs, you know, they ref our games are Caucasian referees. And, you know, a handshake and hello, how you doing? And some may even, you know, bring up a conversation with me. So I wouldn't say that they're, you know, racist in that term, like, you know, old school racist, black and white drinking fountain, things like that. But, you know, just an implicit, a biased thing that's, you know, not necessarily conscious that they are aware of. And it just, you know, I mean, it comes out when you break down the numbers and the stats. And like you said, the studies that's been shown, I mean, documentation beat conversation. So,
right. You know. And when you say that too, coach, you know, the Rockford Register Star reported that just 14 of 65 Rockford basketball officials are black. Do you see that as part of the problem?
It could be, I don't see it as being, you know, a sole part of the problem, but, you know, on the girls side too, you know, referee, just finding quality referees, that's kind of hard as well as the referees are getting older.
Of any color, right, yeah, right.
You know, of any color. So, you know, when you speak of the overall group, you know, you just can't channel it that, but according to our conversation today, you know, and the team and experiences that we've had, you know, it's been a really big issue.
Right. And I'm thinking about a men's high school basketball coach in East Chicago, Indiana. He made similar comments after his team lost to a controversial foul call late in the game. That coach, Pete Turgovich, he said he thought white officials cheated his mostly black team out of the win. And he questioned why a black ref had never officiated one of his team's games. Do you hear coaches talking? Do coaches talk about this?
Not publicly. Where we at today? Yeah. They, you know, we don't talk about it. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And that's another thing. We just don't talk about it. And then, you know, as athletes and certain coaches and people, you know, you always, you know, as far as me, I teach adversity. So, you know, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, what happens to you. It's kind of what you do about it. So you kind of do that, but then, you know, when you when you take something away from kids, that's a hard lesson to learn. And,
yeah, what did you say to your team? What did you say to the girls after the loss?
And I just told them, I embraced them, told them I loved them. And, they played a, man, really great season. You know, we try not to just harp on that game. So I really tried to paint the picture overall. Look what we've done, the history we've made. And, and I really had a great group of girls. I'm talking about good people, respectful, polite. And I just told them, you know, your character will take you where your talent can't keep you. So 4 out of 5 of my girls already signed to go to college and play ball. So that's that's priceless.
That's priceless. So yeah, that's great.
I just rung that home, you know.
I'm speaking with L.A. Malone. He's head coach of Rockford East girls basketball team. To help us understand a little bit more about the research, I wanted to bring someone else in this conversation. Joseph Price is an associate professor of economics at Brigham Young University, and he's one of the authors of that study that I was just talking about a little bit ago. Joseph, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what does the research say? What did you see when you looked at racial bias with NBA referees and calling fouls? What does the data show?
Well, so we'd done an earlier study where we showed there was racial bias in foul calls, and it was an own race bias. It just meant that white referees called fewer fouls on white players and black referees called fewer fouls on black players. And this study got a lot of media attention in May 2007. And so in this follow-up study, we just looked to see if it had an effect on the racial bias in the NBA. And it looks like the media attention basically made it go away almost right away.
Oh, interesting. So the fact that people started talking about it led to an actual change?
Yeah, it actually, it looks like the referees were a little slower to blow the whistle. So the number of fouls called actually dropped quite a bit. That was enough of a pause, it looks like, to have made the racial gaps go away.
And did the NBA play a role in trying to bring about change by addressing this issue? Or was this something that referees started policing themselves?
Well, I mean, we reached out to the NBA. They claimed that there was no racial bias there to begin with, and so there was no reason for them to do anything. But we think it operated largely through referees kind of learning about their own bias and then policing themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think that – is it something as – I don't want to say simple, but do you think the research suggests that being made aware – of racial bias is enough to bring about a change?
Well, I think it's part of a set of tools. The thing is, I think we've done a really good job at getting rid of explicit forms of racial bias, but all of us harbor stereotypes that affect the kind of small decisions we make every day. And so I think as we become aware of how those implicit biases affect our decisions, we can maybe do things to change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well. We've been talking with L.A. Malone, the coach, Joseph Price, the researcher. Kirk Gibson is with us as well. He's on the line from Peoria. He's Associate Executive Director of IHSA. Hey, Kurt, thanks for joining our conversation as well. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Kurt, as you're listening to this conversation, I wonder, is the IHSA actively trying to recruit more minorities for officiating in basketball? I know it's tough as it is, it seems like, to get referees in general, but what do you guys think about this issue?
Well, I think nationally there's a shortage of officials in all sports. Yeah, we're trying and using every means we can to try and attract new officials to the avocation. You know, our numbers, our registration numbers are down. You know, I've been with the association now for 15 years, and there was a time when we would have licensed over 15,000 officials, and that's across all sports. This year, that number's down around 12,000. So it is getting harder and harder for state associations like ours to recruit and then retain officials after a period of time. So it's a very common challenge everybody's facing, and certainly, you know, we hope and through our promotional efforts that we're doing things in a way that attracts officials from all walks of life, all races, and all genders to take on the avocation.
Yeah, is there diversity training that referees go through when they sign up to officiating games? What kind of training goes into getting certification from IHSA to ref games?
Yeah, getting an initial certification is going to involve completing an application. We'll do a background check on an official. We'll provide some training materials in the sports for which they register. We make available clinics, not only through our office directly, but through officials' associations, trying to help officials, you know, learn how to officiate the sports that they register for. And while part of that falls on our office in terms of making materials available, the lion's share of that really falls on officials' associations. They're the ones who are, you know, taking some of the promotional efforts we make, getting out into the streets, so to speak, of communities all around our state and trying to attract people into their association where they can then take some of the initial work that we've done and expand on that through mentoring programs to try and help bring officials along.
Mm-hmm. Kurt, have you ever personally heard of any complaints to the IHSA about racial bias among referees?
It's very common that we get complaints during all kinds of sports in our postseason about various kinds of biases.
Mm,
you know, it's
okay.
Very common when someone loses a game, and especially in our postseason, that there are, you know, at least from one side of the issue, there are a lot of reasons why the team lost the game. And unfortunately, a lot of times it falls, you know, that finger of blame falls in the direction of the official. It might be because of the official's race. It might be because they aren't used to seeing a certain team or style of play. It could be that there was, you know, previous episodes with other schools in the same conference. I mean, there's any number of reasons why our office is contacted, and especially in the postseason, like I said, following a team's loss in any of our tournaments.
Sure. Coach, I wonder if you might weigh in. Do you feel like style of play, is that something that you think sometimes, I mean, all officiating is subjective, right? So I wonder what your thoughts are on that issue, Coach.
Like you said, that definitely plays a role when you got referees and maybe they might have seen a team out of that conference and, you know, they might feel a certain type of way and make certain calls. So it all, like I said, it is all a collective effort and a lot of things go into a game. But the highlight of it all is, like you said, in the postseason, you know, it's either win or go home. So sometimes
it makes it real tough.
You know, point to blame or, you know, they get complaints and it's kind of like, you know, where do they start? You know,
well,
so
Coach,
you really
we just
have to evaluate them. The complaints.
Yeah, we just have about a minute left, and I wonder if I could just let you offer what advice you'd like to see. You're one of the few people who's spoken out publicly about this. We did reach out to lots of different people to try to get them to talk about this on the air, and we had a real tough time, to be honest with you. So I wonder if I could let you have the last word and just think, what advice would you offer out there for either people who want to help recruit more minorities officiating, or what you want people who are training these referees to know?
It's kind of like the old school's concept. It takes a village to raise a child. So even on this conversation alone, I learned a lot of things. Those studies I weren't particularly aware of. So, you know, us being open and talking about it, and like you say, everybody evaluating themselves and kind of doing their own judge. I heard earlier we talked about the NBA. And see, it's more on the professional side with them. So, you know, they have to be aware of that type of thing and the extra training and things that they have to do to perfect their craft, and they also get fined too. So bringing it down to our level, and when we bring in youth and the uplifting of our society and our communities, it just has to be a totally community, everybody-based effort, and we have to be willing to talk about it too.
Thanks for taking the time to talk with us. It's L.A. Malone, head coach of the Rockford East girls basketball team. I want to thank Kurt Gibson from IHSA and Joseph Price, who teaches at BYU. All of you gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.